So I want to start by asking you about Knox, the really gorgeous book of poems that you put together. It's kind of a memory of your brother, but it's just been presented as choreography. And I wondered if you see dance as poetry.
No, I don't think I know enough about dance to see it as anything but dance. However, my husband, collaborator, Curry, has a lot of friends who are dancers. So when I met him, I started talking to dancers and working with dancers. And seems like, well, it's a way to explore a thing further, Curry always says, once I've done something, that's nice, but what can it become now?
Oh.
He's a process person. We have an ongoing debate about product versus process, because I'm kind of a product person. But anyway, so I thought, well, this process thing is probably worthwhile. I'll try that for some time. And so I got to doing things with dancers. And so far, it's been productive.
So this isn't the first time that you've worked with dancers on your work.
No, I did something with these same dancers and a few others for a couple of projects prior to this. One was an essay on pronouns that turned into sonnets. So it was a sequence of sonnets with a dance video and live dancers in front of the video. And another one was a project called Stacks, which was moving a lot of cardboard boxes around the stage.
What I find fascinating about this, in part, is that you are a classicist, and classicists often, I won't say always, believe most in form. That seems not to be at all true for you.
Well, depends what you mean by form. I think for the ancients, form was, they didn't have a word for that, really. They had genres, but genres arose out of occasions. So if you were getting married, you would hire a poet to make a wedding song. And if you had a death, you would hire someone to make a funeral lament. And going to war, you need a war song. But there weren't people sitting around trying to think up forms like sonnets and villanelles just to amuse themselves with language. But we have a completely different view of how poetic activity works, and we don't have those kind of occasions anymore demanding certain kinds of language. So it's all become an invention. So form now is, to me, is a way of setting the thought free.
So it's important, but in a new and more modern way, I guess.
Yeah, more modern, or at least more, I don't know, egotistical, really, is the difference between those two kinds of approach. Everything in modern culture is about being original and making your little face visible among the mass of other little faces on the screen. So it's about poetry. Forms become about inventing something that wasn't there before. For Homer, that wasn't the case. He was happy to settle into the old dactylic hexameter and do it just the same as everybody always did.
Somehow that doesn't sound quite right, though, does it? Because maybe he did everything the same way everybody else did it, but the rest of it didn't survive, so we don't know. He seems unique.
His thought is unique, but there's a kind of collaboration between his thought and his form that's already available to him when he sits down to do his whatever he did. It's already there. He locks into a method and he goes ahead like a train on a track. For us, there's a tension. There's always a search in between. There's a gap in between what we want to say and how to say it. And that gap is produced, I don't know, by a whole lot of modern emotions that Homer didn't have to worry about.
Is this one of the reasons why you have worked in so many different forms? I'm not even sure that form is the right word. So your work is so varied. I mean, you've written essays, you've written poems, you have what look like poetry to me, but you call them short talks. You've done prose, you've done screenplays, you even, I understand, have done a kind of combination play graphic novel. You're searching all the time for the best way to present your ideas.
Yes, it's searching. That's exactly right. Or groping. Searching sounds more positive and directed. It's more like groping. Because really the form has to arise out of the thought. So it's a way of, as I say, setting it free somehow from all the things that are impediments to what it wants to be. That sounds a little pretentious, but there is some kind of inherent form in an idea. And I don't think that I can find a way to let the idea come out unless I get the right form.
How does it work? And I guess I'm curious because I know that you have done a lot of work in translation, and it seems to me that the same thing is true there. How do you know when you approach an idea what the best way to present it is going to be?
No, I hardly ever know. I mess around and mess around and mess around and look for accidents and stare out the window and put down on the page whatever happens in the room just to try to make something come out of unexpectedness. The expected thing is what I'm trying to get away from, and that's difficult to do, very difficult.
So you're looking for the moment of surprise.
Yes. Because that means I've detached myself from my assumptions about what it is. And then I get into a free space where the thing, the thought, and me are working together without presumptions about each other.
Maybe we could take a couple of examples to get a feel for it. The short talks are something that I found very appealing. They look pretty standard on the page. How does form serve you in the production of those short talks?
Well, that's now a good example of the function of accident, because those were originally drawings. I mostly in my early years had no interest in writing particularly. I wanted to be a person who made drawings and did a lot of drawings. And I made a book of drawings called Short Talks, which had titles. And nobody liked the drawings, but they did like the titles, so I started to expand the titles into very long titles, and then they became talks, and then the drawings kind of faded out of the thing, and it got published as a book. But it was entirely backwards, you see, the way it came to be a little thing on a page that looked like a lecture was not what I intended at all.
I love some of these, and maybe it's just that the way in which you phrase them brings those pictures so to life. The little short talk on reading, the last line when you say, "I do not look at hair on female flesh without thinking deciduous." Is that a real memory for you of being in the car while your father drove you and you read in the back seat?
No, I made that up, but it came out of a drawing of a mountain. See, that was the interesting thing about having the drawings subtracted forcibly by somebody else from the book, is that I then had to, in my own mind, put the drawing back into the language without having a drawing be there as such. So that's what made the language different, I think. That's what makes it satisfying to the mind's eye in those talks, because there's so much of the visual linkages between what was happening in the drawing that had to get put into the language somehow.
There's another that I found appealing on the Mona Lisa, and I'm wondering now, after hearing you talk, what your drawing must have been. This short talk, has the idea going back and forth as though poured from the portrait into the mind of the artist and back.
Oh, yes, I remember that one. It was just cups.
It was just cups of water going back and forth?
Yeah, cups of something.
And from that you saw the Mona Lisa?
I did, yeah. I've always been fascinated by that painting because I don't find it attractive in any way. I don't know if you do, but it's a mystery to me why people are fascinated by it, and there must be something something at the back of it that gets poured out and poured in when you look at it.
I think part of the appeal of the Mona Lisa is that everybody knows they're supposed to find it appealing.
And so they do. That's another way of pouring, isn't it? Some Rembrandt pouring this tactic into you, Leonardo. I mean, yeah, I'd.
Two of your most recent works, I guess, are along this same line, aren't they? They're not just words on the page. Nox and, do you say Antigonic or do you say Antigonic?
Antigonic, I say.
It makes sense when you realize that it's Antigone that we are talking about.
Yeah, it's Antigone with an extra character named Nick.
Who measures things. Another entry of form into poetry.
Well, yeah. With plays, it's harder because the play, especially an ancient Greek play, has a form of its own. But then it has to be reimagined by somebody who stages it. So that I think the task in translating a play is to make it into a form that has enough space in it that the people who eventually perform it can invent for themselves the form. So you make a form that's kind of a shell in which they'll put their own form, their interpretation. So Nick is an aspect of that. He's just a free element that a director could do anything he liked with. He's just a guy who's mute but measures everything that happens on stage somehow. And I don't know how that would work in a production. So that's a free element for somebody else to invent.
That really doesn't bother you a bit, though. In fact, you invite the reader or the director or the actor to participate in the act of creation.
I do, yeah. I look forward to that. It is a space. You're trying to make a space in between yourself and somebody else in the world for the both of you to think a third thing, not something I'm giving and you're taking, but some third thing that neither of us expected to think until we got here.
And that's the same thing, it seems to me, perhaps, in the way you write poetry in general. You are recognizing boundaries, but refusing to be bound by them.
Yes. Well, why would anyone do anything else with boundaries? I like boundaries. I don't think anything wrong with them, but they're there to mark a space that you want to test. It's always about testing, because there wouldn't be a boundary there if there wasn't something interesting on the other side, too.
Maybe that's an interesting point to which to turn to Nox, the work that, as I understand it, began as a collection of things as you thought about your brother. Is that a reasonable description?
Not so much a collection I don't know what to call it, a foray. I wanted to remember him, so I bought an empty book which had, I don't know, 70 or so pages in it, and I determined to make something on each page that was different than the page before, so that I didn't want to figure out a sort of nifty way to do the pages and do all of them the same. I wanted to just start again on each page. So each page has text and drawing and paint and staples and stuff, but the method of making them had to keep varying. And the attempt to invent it again on each page drew me into a certain kind of thinking about him that made the text. I have put that very clearly, but there was a kind of cooperation between the physical invention of the pages and the linguistic invention as it went along. So it was in a way trying to see what to make out of something, because the puzzle of him was that I had never known what to make out of him.
Well, it's an interesting way to look at his life, isn't it? Because though you could have simply taken all of the good moments of his life and written a nice lyric poem about them, I suppose, this is a more fully realized version, whether it's your version or his, I don't know.
I think, again, it's in between. Because it was invented without presumption about what it should be, it kind of enters into the space of him and then allows him somehow to speak too. I think there is a voice of him in it, although I didn't put it there because I don't know what that would be.
The production of the book, Knox, is also a change from the way in which things like that are usually presented. It comes, I haven't seen it directly, I've seen pictures. It comes in a box and it is essentially an accordion fold, so you could put it up on the wall the way you could put a panorama up.
Yes, you can unfold it on your kitchen floor. Or a better thing to do if you have a multi-story house is to go to the top of a stairway and drop it down. Because it makes it, it unfurls page by page, and it makes this wonderful crackly sound as it unfurls. And it doesn't hurt it. It's a pretty strong book.
So it adds one more element of sound to something that's also...
Yes, performance.
So how do you read it? If you drop it from the top of the stairwell, do you read step 14 first and then go up and read it on the third step and then roll down the steps and read the end?
It's more of a gesture of ecstasy, the throwing it down the stairs. Then you could go down and gather it up and read it in order if you wanted to. But a funny thing we did with that book, Curry and I, was after it was published, the publisher, New Directions book, the publisher, Declan Spring, has two sons at a school in Brooklyn, and they invited us to go in and sort of talk about the book with the students. So this was a class of grade four, so they were about 8 years old, 9 years old. And we gave them a copy of the book and turned it over because the back of all the pages is blank. We turned it over the blank side and asked them to make their own book on the back, which they did in groups of two and three. They each made a page with all sorts of resources and words and language, and it was just fantastic.
It enriched the poem in a way that maybe you couldn't have expected.
Totally unexpected, yeah. They tried to capture a memory or the importance of memory on the page, each of them, and they made a little event of memory. And, yeah, it was completely rethinking of the book in another way. And then they put it up on the wall of the school in the hallway. Everybody was so happy that day.
You know, this isn't what most people would call poetry. Do you call it poetry?
No, I don't think I do, really. I don't know what to call it. In ancient Greek, they just call poetry making. You know, poiesis means making. That seems respectful of the activity.
Do you like labels?
It depends.
Well, they help readers sometimes, don't you think? Coming into a poem, having forms gives you a place to start. Maybe you need those at the beginning and then can get away from them?
Yeah, I guess I see that point. It's like, where do you put this in the bookstore question? It's always a problem. But I think, yes, I think I like some labels. I like the ones like essay that are completely expansive. I've written a lot of things that I called essays because no one can exactly say what that is. It's, more freedom in it.
Speaking of essays, I was reading one recently about technique and form, and it argued that writers need to learn to excel in classical forms in order to refine their craft. I suppose the idea is that they need to learn what the constraints are so they can surmount them. It'll somehow make them better writers. Does that make sense to you?
Well, I don't know much about forms, standard English forms. I think I never was trained in that. So I guess for me that kind of exercise would be a way of putting in time till you have an idea. And then once you have the idea, well, it will come with its own form and you do that. So, yeah, I don't do a lot of sitting around writing villanelles to train myself.
What's fascinating in a way is that I understand you were a classical scholar by training, a professor of classics. A lot of people would assume that that means you would have a thorough understanding of forms. You're saying that's completely untrue.
Well, I never took English, so the English forms are foreign to me. I took Greek and Latin, and as I say, those forms are genres. They're occasions of life. They're not invented literary artifacts. It's a whole different approach to what a poem does for its audience.
I think that's fascinating because you've done so much translation. You say you never took English, so your translation was from something you knew inside out into something you hadn't studied except as a, like the rest of us, a normal person who speaks the language.
An amateur, yeah. Totally amateur, yes. But that's why...
You say that with a smile.
Well, yeah, I guess I do, yes. But the thing about being an amateur is that it opens out that space for the third thing to happen. If I'm totally professional and locked into my credentials as a professional, I can't let you have a thought about what I'm telling you. I have to make you have my thought about what I'm telling you. And I just don't like doing that. It's not teaching. It's closing off teaching.
I like that. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, I'm thinking now about how this affects the reading of the fragments of Sappho that you have offered. There isn't a lot of Sappho for us to look at, is there? There's one more or less complete Sappho poem?
Yeah, just one. The rest are fragmentary.
And in that sense, you have to find a way to take those fragments and make some sense of them, whether there's a form to it or not.
Yes. But sense, you know, we've all learned from the history of psychoanalysis that any five words on a page will become a story when you go in and start thinking about your childhood. There just is sense everywhere. So I think with Sappho, the main thing to do is to hold off giving a sense and let the sense emerge for the reader from what's left there and from the spaces around it. However, it's an interesting thing with that book that in the response to it, several people, I would say maybe half a dozen people since I published it, have written to me or sent me projects that they did filling in all the blanks. So making Sappho a complete text with sentences that go from right to left to right of the page. And it's kind of an endearing thing to do, but it's so hopelessly silly.
And yet, I suppose that is in some ways what each of us does looking at it. You have, not on the pages perhaps, that have 17 blanks and one word.
Well, you do in a way, but here's what you really do with that. You have the text there with the blanks, and you have your filled-in supposition in your mind, and somehow both of them are able to be layered and to be real in your consciousness at the same time. So you have the presence and the absence together, which is totally thrilling. I mean, that's what we like about poetry, that it does that all the time. It gives and it doesn't give at the same time. And that's why translating is so fascinating, because as a translator, you're in that state of mind perpetually of having the words that are of the original and the possibilities that might translate it, but of course they never quite do, and it can all float at the same time in your mind with all the tensions among them existing. That's a fantastic thing.
Listening to your talk, I realize that each time you approach a poem, whether it's one that you've written or someone else has, it's a new experience for you.
Completely new, yes. There's a poem of Sappho's, Fragment 31, when I published the Sappho book, one of my former students pointed out to me that I have translated it six other times in various academic articles or something in different ways. They thought that was irresponsible. I thought it was just the right attitude.
It sounds like it to me. Well, and it also makes my next question almost pointless, but I'm going to ask it anyway. What's next? What are you working on now?
Well, a couple things. I have a novel. I wrote a novel, sort of a novel, some time ago, years ago, called Autobiography of Red. And then Curry, my collaborator, husband, said, why don't you write a sequel to that? That would be fun. And So I'm trying to do that, and it's very difficult. That's one thing. I'm also translating the Bacchae of Euripides, that play about Dionysus, for a theater in London. And that's quite a challenge. It's a very hard play, very hard play.
Is there a character you can add that would make it easier?
I think I can't add to Euripides. Euripides is chock full. I think a little over full, actually. I would like to take things out of Euripides, but that'd be presumptuous.
Many people wouldn't know. They might like the result better.
They wouldn't. Well, I'm thinking of my scholarly audience as well. The classicists wouldn't approve of that at all. But another thing, weird thing that somebody wants to do with a thing I wrote a while ago, a TV show. Do you know there's a journal, an online journal of literature called Electric Literature? You may have read it. It comes from New York. It's available in physical form, but it's also online. You can get it as an app on your phone. But their mission is to do things that associate literature with new media of all kinds. So they took this thing that I wrote, and they're going to put it into a video game.
Oh, my.
Yeah, that's what I said.
Will you play it?
I've never played a video game in my life. You know, I thought they were all about war and killing, so I've avoided them. But this apparently is a whole different ethos of video game. And so what this text I wrote, it's a TV show about a guy named Crap who has a talk show. And so Crap interviews people, and presumably in the video game you'll be able to go and be in the audience of the TV show while Crap interviews, you know, Martin Heidegger or Antigone or whoever he's got on that night. And then as part of the video game, you can follow the characters. So you could go back into the green room with Antigone and see what she says to Martin Heidegger while they're waiting for their time slot. Or you could follow Crap home and see where he lives. Or you could talk to the next person in the audience. It's the possibilities are manifold.